Yeah, good morning. I'd like to call the Senate Finance Committee meeting to order. Please sign off on the cell phone. The time is 9 o'clock on Friday, May 12th, 2023. I have with me Co-Chair Hoffman, Co-Chair Stedman, Senator Merrick, Senator Keel, and Senator Wilson. Senator Merrick, Senator Bishop will be by shortly. He's away on another state business. With that, we have two bills on the agenda. First is Senate Bill 88 by Senator Diesel. This bill was previously heard. It's the retirement system defined benefit option. We've invited testimony Mr. Gene Kowarski and Michael Mole from Chiron were hired by the Senate Finance Committee to produce the actuarial analysis on SB 88. My staff are out. Ken Alper will go ahead and take care of the slides, and after that we'll have committee discussion. First of all, we need to adopt the CS. At ease. Call the Senate Finance Meeting back to order. Mr. Kowalski and Mr. Mole, are you on, sir?
Can you hear me? This is Mr. Kowalski.
You're coming in loud and clear.
Yes, we can hear you loud and clear.
Oh, Mr. Mole, is he on as well?
Yes, I'm on too, thank you.
Okay. Go ahead and identify yourself for the record, and then go ahead with your testimony.
So we're prepared to start?
Yes, please do.
Okay. I'm going to talk about a few things about our company, about our experience. Then I'll get right into the cost estimates. We're going to show you some projections and your information. We're not going to speak to it.
Mr. Kowarski.
Yes.
Please identify yourself for the record.
My name is Gene Kowarski. I'm CEO and actuary with the consulting firm Chiron.
Okay, thank you. Go ahead with your presentation.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead with your presentation.
Okay. So I'm on slide two. Our firm was formed 21 years ago, and we've grown 100 plus strong. And I just want to mention that we have been often called on some of those challenging assignments around the country. We've been in Illinois, New Jersey, San Diego retirement systems, Detroit, and wherever there had been challenges, it seems like we've been called on. On slide three, there's a listing of our clients, both statewide and local government plans. We also do health work. I might mention that as far as your plan, Alaska, we have done work with a House bill last year that was similar to Senate Bill 88. And actually, many, many years ago, when you had an actuary by the name of Mercer, we were called in to review Mercer's work by your attorneys. So we've had experience looking at your plan. Slide four, we basically ran all the people in the DCR plan through as though all their service counts towards the DB plan. And then we compared that liability to what they had in their DC plan. If they had enough money, then all that service would count. If they didn't have enough money, we would prorate down that service in the DB plan. And then we reran the valuation just to include the service that was covered by the DCR balances. Slide five.
Mr. Kowarski, we have a question for Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We've had substantial financial market return deltas the last couple of years. So can you let us know what your ending dates were on the accounts that you ran, and then by chance, did you run them the previous year before the market slide?
Mr. Kowarski.
Mr. Stedman, and through the chair, we ran everything as of June 30th, 2021, so we did not reflect the most recent market downslide, and we did not do a run for the previous year.
Follow-up, Senator Stedman.
No, I don't have the market charts in front of me, but June 30th, 2021, predated a good portion of the market correction. Is that correct?
Mr. Kowarski.
Mr. Stedman, through the chair, that is my understanding. Yes.
Go ahead with your presentation if there's no more. No, there are no more further questions at the table right now.
Still, I'm on slide five, and that's a snapshot of the results of our valuation. And on the top half, we have counts by the teacher system, PERS other, and PERS safety, and then total. And in the middle of that page is a line called actuarial liability, showing you broken down by each system, and in total, $1.619 billion. To the extent there were market downturns after this, that liability would go down because the DC account balances would be smaller, and therefore would buy less service. Then we go to the very bottom. We project the 21 results to fiscal year 24 costs, and you see on the far right the total cost for the normal cost, which pays for the annual accrual of benefits, is 13.17. The SB 88 employee rate we assume would start at 8%, can go as high as 12. That leaves an SB 88 employer cost of 5.17. And what the employers are currently paying towards DCR is 5.42, leaving a change in the employer rate of minus 0.6%, which we project based on the payroll. We estimate in 2024 to be a savings of $5.5 million. We then did a series of long-term projections.
Mr. Kowarski. We have a question for Senator Stedman.
So maybe you could give us a little bit more information so it's a little easier to follow. So I assume in your analysis you assume 100% transfer from the existing defined contribution into a defined benefit?
Mr. Stedman, and through the chair, yes, we assumed a 100% transfer.
Yeah. Senator Stedman.
Yes, it'd be helpful in the presentation for a little bit more background information when you go through the slides so we can follow them along, because we haven't had a detailed breakdown of some of the legislation and dealing with some of the finances of it.
Mr. Kowalski.
Mr. Stedman, through the chair, we have that information in a more formal report, which is summarized by this smaller presentation. That report will be available as soon as Mr. Alford can pass it around.
Mr. Chair.
We have another question. Do you need another follow-up, Senator Stedman?
Yeah, I'd like to know when that report was done and delivered to the finance chairman.
Mr. Kowalski.
Mr. Stedman, through the chair, a draft report was submitted, and we were going to submit the final report following this meeting.
Senator Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm just wondering here do you run any other simulations that have maybe quartered out of 50% transferring, 25% transferring, 75% transferring, just so we can see a better model? Because I just don't believe 100% will just automatically transfer, just so we can have a better baseline of the presumptions that you are presenting today.
Go ahead, Mr. Kowalski.
Assume that was Mr. Wilson, and through the chair. If you look at the table that we have on slide five, if 50% were to transfer over, it would simply take those liabilities and numbers, dollar numbers, and multiply them by 50%.
Follow-up, Senator Wilson?
Yeah, I mean, that's easier said than done. I'm just wondering if you run those models throughout your combined baselines throughout the rest of your presentation, showing the graphs and data.
Mr. Wilson, and through the chair, I'm not sure I understood the question.
Can you repeat the question again, Senator Wilson?
Yeah, through your stress testing projections, are you also assuming 100% transfer over at that time?
Mr. Wilson, and through the chair, yes, we are. And but again, if we were to assume 50% or 25% or 75% transferring, you would simply take the same result and multiply it by that factor.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, if I could.
Go ahead.
Yeah. You know, you're running these returns and assumptions. I can't do that math going through your tables and just off the top. It'd just be simpler if that could just be provided to the committee, or if you did not, then just say, hey, we didn't do that. But I can do, you know, obviously it's 50%, it's half, and that's just common assumptions. And that's sort of, that's fine, Mr. Chair. It's harder to see how this is going to work through on those assumptions, on those baselines, and we're assuming 100%. We know 100% is not going to go through this, and it'd just be easier to see maybe some other baselines of 80%, 75% on just maybe on other PERS and TERS, or maybe just a survey done through public employees to get a better baseline of how many people would go over to get a better estimation. And these are some large numbers, large dollars, and a percent, 2%, 3%, you know, we're talking millions of dollars. And so that's why I asked. I mean, I could just do the simple math and just cut it in half, but it's better for the public to see that. And not everyone can just easily just visualize that as easy as our actuarial folks presenting today and other members that are normally seeing these numbers. It's trying to have a plain view for the public, Mr. Chair.
Is there a question there, Senator Wilson?
Yes, just wondering if that could be provided to the committee at not at 100%, but maybe at a better estimate of how many perceived employees will transfer throughout this time period.
Is that a possibility, Mr. Kolarski?
Mr. Wilson's question, and through the chair, that is possible. We can provide it. I do want to explain that the reason we're assuming 100% is because that was the worst case scenario that produced the highest cost. Anything less than that would produce lower costs.
Follow up, Senator Wilson. If not, thank you very much for. Oh, I'm sorry, Senator Stedman.
Yeah, it's unfortunate that we don't have the analysis previous to the meeting to actually ask some detailed questions on a complex issue as this. So that's unfortunate. So it would be nice to have that report, Mr. Chairman, as soon as possible so our staff has the time and ourselves to read through it and actually have, you know, some data to review the subject matter at hand. It doesn't sit well, put it that way. So, but with that, what I'd like to do is have in this presentation, some of the things that are going to be of major concern is the $7 billion unfunded liability we have at on the table already from the past defined benefit plans. And when we alter the or roll in a new tier, we have a lot of communities that are part of the unfunded liability, and the state is picking up anything north of 22%. And there is some concern on tracking that potential impacts, that we don't have a situation with a new tier that would allow the communities outside, you know, the non-state entities to roll that liability towards the state. So we need to have the math gone through in detail to make sure that that does not happen. And I don't know, and also then how the new tier will impact the unfunded liability that we're carrying on the books today, trying to pay that off. And I recognize this new tier doesn't start with an unfunded liability, but that's a major issue that hopefully in your slides you can point out along the way. And then when you get into the cost sharing, which this plan does propose, some variable rates, that you walk the committee through that, because the major issue dealing with the retirement system is the unfunded liability hot potato. Nobody wants it. So we need to thoroughly understand that issue, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Kowalski, can you get that information to us as soon as possible? And I will have my staff, Ken Alpers, go ahead and make sure that you are reminded to do it until we get it. But go ahead with your presentation if there's no further questions.
Well, through the chair, I was going to say that in the slides, beginning on slide 7, we will be showing the impact of SB 88 on the unfunded.
Okay, thank you very much. Continue on with your presentation.
I am on slide 7.
I have a question on slide 6.
We have a question by Senator Stebbins on slide 6.
So I'm just kind of curious. I know you didn't, I guess it wasn't on the screen when you touched on it. But it looks like there's an overfunding on it north of 2045 or somewhere in there. So you can help me understand that slide the issue of the overfunding. Why would we run that overfunding?
Mr. Kowalski.
Mr. Stedman, slide 6 is just a generic picture. It's not representative of Alaska. It's just a title page, stress testing projections. The analysis begins on slide 7.
Okay.
Go ahead, Mr. Kowalski. We're on slide 7.
All right. Let me provide an explanation of what's going on here, this slide and all the slides that follow. To the far left, you're looking at in the white bars, the return that's being assumed in this projection, 7.25 is being assumed each and every year. And if that were the return, the employer contribution is shown in the green column, and the impact on the unfunded is shown in the pink column. There is no impact, as you can see, because we're assuming no gains or losses, or you're going to earn exactly 7.25. Under that scenario, the top graph is showing a projection of the liabilities, and the assets are, that's the gray bars, and the assets are the lines. There's a smooth asset and a market value of assets, but since you're earning exactly 7.25 each and every year, there's no smoothing going on, and the plan just maintains 100% funding throughout. And we're not saying this is an accurate projection, because in no world does one earn exactly the same amount each and every year. I'm just trying to explain what the graphs show. The bottom chart shows in the dark blue the employee contributions to the DB plan under SB 88, and the gold bars are the employer contributions. And the red line is the contribution that would go otherwise into the DCR. So this slide shows you all three systems combined. We go to slide 8, and that's just the teachers. If you compare 7 and 8,
Mr. Kowalski,
all three combined.
Mr. Kowalski.
I'm sorry.
Senator Stedman has a question on slide 6.
I have a couple, Mr. Chairman. I need clarification on the red line, the portion that you said would otherwise go to the unfunded liability. And I think we all recognize that in a perfect world, under the assumptions that the math's going to work. And there's no question there. Obviously, the concern is when financial irregularities and or market conditions change. So help me with that red line. Again, you need to go into more detail about what's the impact on our current position.
Mr. Kowalski.
Mr. Stedman, through the chair. The red line is the contribution, if not for SB 88, that would be paid into the DCR, defined contribution plan. It has nothing to do with the unfunded. The impact on your system is that pink column. And the pink column are all zeros because you're earning exactly 7.25, so no unfunded liability emerges.
No, that's maybe I'm garbling up the question. I understand that. The concern is the $7 billion that we have on the books of an unfunded liability. Right now, we count all payroll, and then there's contributions made on the entire payroll, and the communities are capped at 22%. So it's not the question of this plan and the basic math model going forward. The question is, what impact does it have on the, if any, on the contributions to the unfunded liability that under the current structure when we count the entire payroll?
Mr. Kalorski.
Mr. Stedman, and through the chair, this is just projecting the subtrust created by SB 88. It does not speak to any of the monies going already towards the legacy plan.
So just for clarifications, then this has no impact on the legacy plans, counting the entire payroll of City X going to the unfunded liability?
Mr. Kalorski. So
that's what I'm trying to figure out. What's the mechanics of that?
Mr. Stedman, through the chair, you are correct. This has no impact on the legacy plan. This is just looking at the impact of what would happen to the legacy plan if SB 88 were implemented.
Bottom center statement.
I think we need to get the department in here because I understand it doesn't impact the plans. I'm talking about the cash flow. The cash flow that where we count the entire payroll of the community, take Sitka because it represents Sitka or Ketchikan, the entire payroll, and we spread that. I want to know if there's any impact on that concept because I'm concerned that I don't want to have an exposure where more of the unfunded liability gets shoved to the state or existing unfunded liability. I'm not concerned about an unfunded liability with this plan in front of us.
Do you want the OMB director to come on up and sing?
Probably retirement benefits would be better, probably, Mr. Chairman, when they come before us. But we need to thoroughly understand that because that will impact all of our communities across the state and roll back to the Treasury.
That are subscribing to the PERS retirement system.
Yep.
Can you make that happen, Mr. Alper?
Through the chair, Ken Alper, staff to the Finance Committee. To Senator Stedman's question, on the calendar tomorrow morning, we have scheduled Buck Consulting, who is the actuary hired by the Department of Administration. I believe the intent is to have our retirement and benefits available for that meeting, and they'll be speaking more holistically, I imagine, that what really they'll be providing is what amounts to the fiscal note for the bill, the overall cost to the system, and theoretically how the changes in this bill might impact the state's cash flow to the towards the unfunded, the amount above the 22% or within the 22% that goes towards that. From what I've seen of their prior analysis, I would expect that sort of information coming from them, and we are expected to receive that late this afternoon. That's why we scheduled them tomorrow morning.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, maybe we can pass that on there. I'm sure they're watching, and I'm sure they understand the question I'm asking. So they're prepared to answer that question because I don't want to see more liability shifted onto the state from the boroughs. That's why we did the count of the payroll in the entirety with a special piece of legislation after we created the current tiers that we have.
Okay, we'll be getting that information. Mr. Kalorski, go ahead with your presentation.
Slide 7. Thank you. As I said before, slide 7 combines all three systems, teachers, public employees, and safety. And then slides 8, 9, and 10 break out the teachers, PERS other, and PERS safety. And you can see, looking at the teachers, the cost of the SB 88 DB plan is much less than the red line DCR cost. For the PERS other, they're kind of very close. And then for the safety, actually, the SB 88 DB costs more than the red line. That's on slide 10. netting them all out was slide seven.
You have a question?
Yeah, I mean, because we're just jumping slides here by handfuls. I'd like you to talk a little bit from your experience. It's clearly your firm is vastly, in a very good position, I guess, looking across the country. So when we look at salary replacement, we're looking at roughly a salary replacement of 67.5%. Is that correct over 30 years?
Mr. Kowalski.
Mr. Stadman, through the chair, that sounds about right.
Okay, and then there has been testimony that we have a fairly rich plan, which is good. When you count in SPS, which is our replacement for Social Security, which is about half of the retirement. So if we look nationwide, where are we, the state, looking at replacing 67.5% of the salary for the PERS employees along with SPS? Because there was a comment by a previous actuary referencing that we may be on the rich side, which I don't have a problem with in that regard, but on the rich side for dealing with other states, because some other states don't have Social Security and they have a replacement, salary replacement somewhere close to ours. So where are we on the scale across the states?
Mr. Kowalski.
Mr. Stedman, through the chair, I don't have the exact data in front of me, but knowing from experience in the plan that I work on, this seems pretty much in the middle of the plans I work on, having a 2% multiplier that increases with service. And so there's nothing that stands out here as an outlier.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to have a more formal answer from him on salary replacement. I think 67% is a reasonable number, but I'd like to know where the other states are and if they're in Social Security or some other replacement so we can look at potential salary replacement.
Mr. Kowalski, if you can get that information, we'd appreciate it.
Through the chair, yes, we can provide that. Just can't do it on the fly here.
Okay. Go ahead with your presentation.
Slide 7 through 10, we're just focusing on baseline. What did you earn exactly as assumed? The rest of the slides now vary the earnings. And on slide 11, we're saying what happens to the costs if we have two strong years. And on slide 11, I'll point to the first column of returns. You see we plugged in 2026 and 2027, 15%. And that shows in the green bar, cost declining because of the gain, and then the pink bars, the impact on the unfunded is that it reduces it. Those are negative numbers. Negative numbers are surpluses. And the bottom graph on slide 11 shows that the gold bars go well beneath the red line. But that's just one scenario of two strong returns. On the flip side, slide 12, what if we have two zeros instead for those years? And that shows costs in the green going up, and in the pink you see in addition to the unfunded, $46 million going as high as $426 million and then declining as it gets paid off. And the bottom chart shows that the gold bars exceed the red line.
Okay, we've got a question on the, if you back up a couple slides, you had public safety. And again, there's no question on the linear math. The question I have here with public safety, we have some public safety, some communities that are members of our retirement system. And they don't include their public safety, fire and policemen in Social Security or our replacement supplemental benefit system, leaving out 50% of their retirement potentially. So how do we cure that? Because if we don't cure that, those employees are going to be left short no matter what system we put in place. So can you help me with that?
Mr. Stedman, through the chair, you're asking what can you do to ensure that the public safety have adequate retirement benefits?
Yes.
One would have to increase the current formulas.
Okay, so some of our communities are included in SBS or Social Security, but there's a significant amount of police and fire that are not. So we'd have to have a split tier for police and fire to cure that? Or that doesn't, how do we, we're struggling with how to cure that deficiency.
Well, Mr. Stedman, through the chair, the proposed SB 88 gives every public employee the opportunity to earn a pension, including those who don't have the SSA or SBS.
Okay.
But SB 88 at least gives everybody a baseline pension, and that, in my opinion, is a cure.
Okay, so we'll take that up with retirement and benefits, because clearly there's a significant amount of employees that are left short. And there's also a concern with TERS dealing, they're not in Social Security or SBS also, so we'll have to take that up with them. So go ahead and continue with your presentation.
So following slides 11 and 12, where we show two strong returns and two poor returns, we then looked at, well, there have been different markets over the years. So starting with slide 13, we said, what if the returns during the period 1930 through 1960 were to reoccur? And that is a period that encompasses the Great Depression. And so in the far left column, it may be hard to see because of the colors, but we're seeing some negative red, large negative returns. In fact, 2025, it's showing a minus 43.7% return. That's the height of the Great Depression. And it's showing the impact of contributions and on the unfunded liability. Negative numbers are good. That's a reduction. Positive are an increase in the unfunded. And in the bottom chart, well, let me start with the top chart. It still shows the fund, because of the strong returns of the 1950s, exceeding 100% funding by the end of the period. And the bottom chart is showing the gold bars and blue bars fluctuate. When the plan falls below 90%, member contributions can go up as high as to 12%. And so you see the volatility in the contributions in the bottom chart.
Mr. Chairman.
But that's just one period in time.
Okay. And
the remaining chart.
Just let me know when you're done with the slide, because we'll have questions, please. And then we'll go to the next slide. So we're still on slide 13.
Mr. Stedman, through the chair, I'm completed.
Okay, we have a question from Senator Keel. Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Kolwarski, can you just tell us, as you look at unfunded created by one of these fluctuations in market returns, in your chart where you show member contributions and employer contributions, are you showing what it would take to retire that unfunded in a single year, or do you spread that over time, and do those then carry forward in this chart?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear who asked the question.
That was Senator Keel.
Mr. Chairman, I apologize. I drifted off at the end. The question, when an unfunded or an overfunded situation appears in this modeled return, do you retire that in the member and employer contributions in a single year, or do you smooth that and retire that over several years?
Mr. Kolwarski.
Senator Keel, and through the chair, a couple smoothing mechanisms take place. First, the return itself is smooth over 5 years, so if you had a minus 40% return in a given year, only one-fifth of that would be recognized in the first year. But whatever is recognized in each year then gets amortized over a 25-year period.
Follow-up, Senator Keel.
No, thank you.
Thank you very much for presenting. Senator Wilson has a question.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just wondering here in the assumptions here of the assets and the when do you start having members draw from the funds? What years do you start to see those payments being made?
Mr. Kowarski.
Senator Wilson, and through the chair, we run each DCR member through our system that projects them until, you know, end of life, and there's probabilities of retirement, and for each individual person, we are making projected payments, and the timing of when they begin to draw payments will vary depending upon each person.
Follow-up, Senator Wilson.
Someone who is 65.
Yeah, just wondering, are those assumptions in within these, in terms of those payments within these projections that we're seeing today?
Senator Wilson, through the chair, yes, they are.
All right. And but we don't know when, if it's year 5, year 10, that your summary starts to have those draws, and those rates of those draws aren't, they're not projected per se just based upon the withdrawals, but just the assumption of the earnings in balance.
Mr. Kowarski.
Senator Wilson, and through the chair, the drawdown begins at different years for each person, depending on the age of the person. Someone who is in their 60s is going to draw earlier than someone who is in their 20s.
Follow-up, Senator Wilson.
Yeah, I understand that. Just wondering, if do you have those projected draw amounts? Was that projected? Just...
Senator Wilson, through the chair, yes, we have those draw amounts.
Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Kowalski. I'm sorry, Senator Stedman.
I just got a real quick question. This goes to the plan itself. I know there's a splitting of costs, which I think is a good idea on these plans. But if we uncap the employee and match the cost increase 50-50 between the employer and employee, is it going to change this much at all on the our risk to the employee? Can you help us with that concept as far as the risk sharing mechanism, which you haven't really addressed when things go underwater?
Mr. Kowalski.
Senator Stedman, and through the chair, the risk sharing concept presently is that the member contributions can be between 8 or 12%. It would increase only when the ARM board increases it, and that can only happen if the funded ratio of the plan falls below 90%. Whatever the member contribution rate would increase by, say if 8 goes to 9, the employer contribution would likewise have to increase by that amount. But once you hit 12, it all falls on the employer. To answer your question, and I'm looking at slide 13, if it were uncapped, if you look at the bottom graph, that spike in the gold bar in 2037, you probably see more of a balance between that and the blue bar next to it if it were uncapped.
Okay, I think that's something to understand, is that capping relationship, because we have constitutional protection, as we all know, of the diminishment of benefits issue. And I think there's a language difference in this bill between what the state does and directed to do and the employer. I think one is mandatory and one is up to the board. So is this a reasonable sharing to cap it at 12, or should it be released so it's 50-50 or some other combination if and when this goes upside down?
Mr. Kowalski.
Senator Stedman, most of the plans, statewide plans in the country, don't have the risk-sharing concept, and the member contribution rate stays fixed. So this requires more of the members than most plans I have seen.
Bottom, Senator Stedman.
Do the other states have the constitutional protection of diminishment of benefits, so all the risk then goes to the state?
Mr. Kowalski.
Senator Stedman, yes, many states do have that, but not all.
Thank you very much. Oh, Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I know we're off the presentation, but it's a good topic. I thought I'd draw on Mr. Kowarski's breadth of expertise. Does is it your understanding that the bill makes any changes at all in how the funds are managed for risk and return, or does that stay the same?
Mr. Kowarski.
Senator Keelan, through the chair, it's my understanding it does not have an impact.
A follow-up?
Got a follow-up for Senator Keel.
On how the money's...
Thank you. And we, I believe, have one employee seat on the Retirement Management Board that does look at those investments and set the risk-return balance. How does that compare to other states? In other states, do employees have more say in that how the funds are managed?
Kowalski.
Senator Keelan, through the chair, most systems have more than just one member representative on the board, if I understood your question correctly.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So it sounds like what we have proposed in front of us is more employee risk with maintaining less employee involvement.
Going with your presentation, Mr. Kowalski, we want to emphasize again that at the end of the slide, if you could pause, and then we'll have questions on that slide if there are any. But go ahead with your presentation.
Thank you. On slide 14, I'm now looking at another period, 1940 to 1970. We don't have the Great Depression happening. So what's going on in this chart is pretty much a very rosy scenario. Employer costs, in fact, go down to zero, and the plan's funding is well over 100%, because without having the down returns of the Great Depression, but having the strong post-World War II returns, things would look great. That's all I have on slide 14.
Senator Stedman has a question, Mr. Kowalski.
We're zipping along here. I think this is a better than the previous year's spread, and the upcoming ones are even better yet, but so the unfunded liability, the pink column, that's in billions. And like in 2043, it's $6.2 billion. Am I reading that right?
Senator Stedman, through the chair, that's a negative $6.6 billion, meaning it's a reduction in the unfunded.
It's a reduction of the unfunded liability?
Senator Stedman, and through the chair, yes, anything negative is reducing the legacy UAL.
Okay. Follow-up, Senator Stedman?
No, I just...
Go ahead with the presentation, Mr. Kowalski.
Thank you. Slide 15, 1950 through 1980. Again, you see the great returns of the 50s. They're dropping the cost to zero, but then we get into some of the economic issues that hit the 60s and 70s, and costs bounce back up. At the end of the period, the plan is 86% funded. Again, in this slide, you see the negative impact on the unfunded through 2043, and then there's a positive increase in the unfunded.
Senator Stedman.
That's it.
So help me with the trigger mechanism. The escalation of the employee and the employer when you have the unfunded liability, which is, I guess, the bottom from 2045 on.
For the employer, it's just, well, we determine a total contribution that's required without first looking at the member. Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't say through the chair, Senator Stedman. I apologize. We look at a total contribution based on amortizing any unfunded that was created that year over 25 years. But if the plan's funded ratio is less than 90%, the ARM board can increase the member contribution, but not more than 12. So we find out what level of increasing both the member and the employer costs would be sufficient to amortize that liability created in that year over 25 years.
Well, I understand that, the rolling. Okay.
Go ahead with the presentation, Mr. Kowalski.
Continue on slide 16, looking at the period 1960 to 1990. So we've got some tough economic periods in there, and it produces costs in the 2030s and 40s that are higher. But then the roaring 90 returns come back and costs drop back down. And on the top chart, those 1990 returns produce a funded ratio of over 150%. That's all I have on slide 16.
Senator Stemmer has a question.
I think it would be helpful if, you know, in your slides, if you had to, or at least get back to the committee if they would, Mr. Chairman. Annually, the unfunded liability or surplus, not with the averages, and I understand the rationale for using the averages to the amortization of the unfunded liability going forward to set rates and stuff like that, but it's also nice to look at the market value year by year of a deficit or surplus. If you could help us with that, so it make it easier for us to see the magnitude of these moves.
Mr. Kowalski.
Senator Stedman, through the chair, the pink column does not have any smoothing. It is exactly what the unfunded liability is added to or subtracted from due to SB 88. So just picking the year 2040, I'm reading a number of $1.339.4 billion. So as of that date, that's what's added to the legacy liability. And then if we go down to 2048, a negative $1.49 billion, that was subtracted from the current legacy.
Okay, so you're comparing it to the – okay, well, I'll have to work on that. You're comparing it to the legacy? Can you define that?
Senator Stedman, through the chair, we're not comparing it. We're just saying because of SB 88, what would be the impact on the legacy liability? Would it increase or decrease?
Okay.
Go ahead with the presentation, Mr. Kowalski.
So slide 17 now brings you through the 30-year period from 1970 through 2000. Largely strong return years. That's just before the dot-com bubble bursts. And we have lots of zero employer contributions in the out years. And the funded status of the plan would reach 189% for this group. That's it for that slide.
Senator Wilson has a question for you.
Yeah, just asking if we can get these slides restated to us. I know that there is an Excel error that's occurring on the next couple of slides, and it's hard to see the numbers, and especially for the public to follow along without seeing those numbers with that Excel error. And the Excel error I mean by is the hash marks because the numbers are too large to fit within the columns.
Senator Wilson, through the chair, yes, we'll send the deck with those columns expanded.
Okay, Mr. Kowalski, go ahead with your presentation.
Slide 18 now is taking you 1980 through 2010. So that is inclusive of the Great Recession of 2008 and 9 and the dot-com burst, but because of this very strong returns of the later 80s and all of the 90s, we've got a plan that remains well-funded and employer costs are zero.
Okay, no further That's questions it. From the committee. Go ahead with you. Continue on, please.
Then finally, slide 19, 1990 to 2020. And again, you see a plan well-funded on the top graph. And then you see gold bars that are beneath the red line and then above for a few years on the right. And that is all I have for that slide.
Okay. No questions at the table. I'm sorry, Senator Wilson.
Just when we start getting into the more modern era in the economy and the markets, from 80 to 210 and then 90 to 220, it doesn't really show a huge, I don't want to say a a delta in between, especially when you go to 2020, it seems pretty negligible in terms of deficits or positives. Is that significantly different in terms of the losses and gains throughout the year and saying that's a fully funded plan?
Mr. Kowalski.
Senator Wilson, through the chair, if you compare the 1980 to the 1990 slides 18 to 19, you're correct on the top chart. They both, in both cases, they remain pretty much fully funded. But if you look at the bottom chart, the contributions that are going in are significantly greater in the latter part, slide 19, than on slide 18.
Follow-up, Senator Wilson? No follow-up. Mr. Kowalski, go ahead.
That pretty much concludes the presentation. Slide 20 is simply repeating what we said on the earlier slide, how we came up with liability.
We have a question by Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Mr. Kowalski. I don't see a slide on the total market return from 1930 to today. Can you provide that, or did I miss it? Just the average market return. So I've been playing with numbers. We started out at 9.74 from 1930 to 1960, and we end with a 9.27 average return from 1990 to 2020. So I just want to know what the average return would be from 1930 to today.
Mr. Kowalski, is that a possibility to get that material to the Finance Committee?
Again, I didn't hear who asked the question, but through the chair, my answer is yes, that could easily be provided today.
Okay, that's Senator Bishop that asked the question. Senator Stemma has a question. Oh, follow-up, Senator Bishop?
Nope.
Well, Senator Stemma has a question.
Yeah, mine again is just that I want to make sure I'm understanding your math and it's clear, because we've got the current plans, the legacy plans, I guess a better way of saying it, with an unfunded liability. So when you're showing the gains or losses on your previous years, you know, when you're running your hypotheticals, that's against the forward projected liability, or taking into account the forward projected liability of the current unfunded plans. So this comparison then, is that correct, where this is looking at kind of the aggregate impact to the state?
Senator Stedman, and through the chair, this is not comparing anything. So you mentioned that the legacy liability was $7 billion. Let's just suppose in 10 years it were $8 billion, just to pick up, making up a number. Whatever's in that pink column 10 years from now, you would add or subtract from that number, depending upon if it's a positive or negative.
Okay.
So I'm looking at the 1930 to 1960 results. And I'm going to 20, and that's slide 13, and I go to 2033, and I see a negative 130.8. So that hypothetical $8 billion I came up with in a legacy would be reduced by the 130.8.
Okay, just so I understand the back methodology, I'm looking forward to your actuarial report when you get it. I'm sure it'll have substantially more detail. Is that correct?
Senator Stedman, through the chair, yes, it'll have details on our summary of SB 88 and all the assumptions that went into these calculations.
Any more questions by members of the committee for Mr. Kowalski? With that, thank you very much for hanging on, Mr. Kowalski. Are you able to stay on the line for a few minutes in case we have questions for you?
Yes, I can.
Okay. We've had Mr. Kowalski and Chiron give their actuarial analysis, and he'll be getting back to us with other information we asked for. In the meantime, we have a committee substitute in front of us. We have a motion, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that we adopt Finance Committee substitute for Senate Bill 88, Work Order 33-LS0505, /Oscar, as our working document.
Thank you very much. Any questions for we'll have Ken Alper, my staff aide, go ahead and explain the changes to the CS.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I believe all the members have the summary of changes document in front of them. And Ken Alper, for the record, staff to the Finance Committee. I mentioned earlier in response to a question you said at the beginning of the hearing, I just want to get again on the record. The changes made in this committee substitute are mostly technical in nature, and nothing in them should materially change any of the benefit or fiscal calculations and assumptions, the numbers in the bill itself. So I just want to get that out there, that should be stable. And that speaks in large part to the excellent work done in the previous committee, in the Labor and Commerce Committee, who spent a lot of time with this bill and cleaned up a lot of the language and got it all pretty solid. There were a few ambiguities, mostly that dealt with unusual circumstances, the scenarios that we hadn't initially thought of that were worked out in the committee substitute. So going through them, for example, you may recall, Mr. Chairman, when the defined contribution system first came in, until in 2006, there were a small pool of non-vested DB employees who chose to join the DC system at that point. The committee substitute clarifies that those people who didn't start in DC but joined it afterwards would also be able to elect to go back to this new DB system created by Senate Bill 88. That's change number one in the bill. Change number two, there was some inconsistent language over when you have a TERS retiree, a teacher under 60, they have to be retired, receiving benefits for a certain period of time before they're eligible for the so-called PERPA, the post-retirement pension adjustment. It's sort of a inflation adjustment in the pension. They need to be earning the benefit for 5 years. That was clarified and made consistent throughout the bill. The third change is really a long-term scenario, Mr. Chairman. What happened, the 22% number that Senator Stedman alluded to, which is the municipal cap, and then the state pays above that, if we get to the place in the future where we've paid down most of this past service liability, and therefore the numbers go down to where the total actuarial cost is less than 22%, the plan allows it to flex downward. But there's a floor, and the employer contribution can't go below 12%. But if we get to the, frankly, Mr. Chairman, highly unlikely scenario where the total actuarial cost of all the past service and the current service is less than 12%, well, what happens if the employers are still paying at the 12%? The committee substitute makes clear that let's call it excess contribution from the employers would be deposited into the subtrusts and be available into the pension system. The change four speaks to a scenario where, so to back up a step, when an employee chooses to go into the new DB system and they already have a fund balance, they're already part of the DC system, there's a dollar value to their account. And what retirement benefits will do is determine how much time they could buy. Maybe they're DC for 10 years, but their investments haven't done well, and therefore they can only buy 7 years worth of time into the new pension system. And then they would have the option of doing the seven, putting in cash to buy up to the full 10, setting up a payment plan. All that was already in the bill. Or, of course, they could opt to stay in the DC system, but setting that aside. What happens, Mr. Chairman, if this person did really well, if they have more money than is needed to buy their full 10 years? And that, more realistically, is the person who maybe they worked 10 years ago, left the state, have their accounts been growing in the markets, and then they come back to Alaska, and now their account is worth more than what's needed to buy the 5 years they worked 10, 15 years ago. Well, we can't let them leave their money in the DC system after they've bought into the DB system. They can't be in both systems at the same time. So change number four clarifies that any excess money they had after buying their full service time would either get moved to their SBS account if they had one, or in the absence of that, another eligible retirement plan. The employee would keep all their money, but they wouldn't be able to keep it in the DC system if they left the DC system. Change number five is this clarifying language over which members are eligible to switch on the effective date of the bill. And it's all members who became a member of the plan after June 30th, 2006, not simply entered into the system. And this goes back to change number one, that small group of people who might have started DB but voluntarily chose to become DC after 2006. But on the effective date, the full pool of active employees will be able to have the option to switch. And finally, Mr. Chairman, change number six. When the window is open for people to switch to the new system, the bill as written came in, gave them 120 days. It's been amended to say they now have 180 days to choose whether or not they want to join the new DB system. So, and that number is a rolling number. Again, if someone is not currently employed by the state but was in the past, they come back to the state, it will open up a new 180-day window for them. And then at the end of the bill, in the so-called transition sections, it talks about the current employees, and instead of 180 days at that point, it puts a date certain. The effective date of the bill would be July 1st, 2024, I believe, and therefore they would have until January 1st, 2025, a little bit more than 180 days, to make their selection to join the new system. And that's it, Mr. Chairman. It relatively small and technical and wonky changes to the bill have been made, but we have a committee substitute that I'm happy to take any questions on.
Senator Wilson.
Yes, thank you. Will employees that decide to switch from defined contributions to the defined benefits plan be given consultation through our divisions of retirements and benefits on their just options and sort of historical data that they normally give employees when they choose to when they're going to retire?
Mr. Halpern.
Through the chair to Senator Wilson, yes, it is my understanding that is the case. Retirement benefits will have a group of people whose job it will be to guide employees through that process. They will have math. They will have some sort of a spreadsheet. And then really the key part of that, through the chair to Senator Wilson, is the valuation. Hey, employee, you've got $200,000. That would be enough to buy 10 years of time, but you've worked for 12 years. Here are your options to potentially buy those that 11th and 12th years. There will be ample guidance, and I believe we'll have R&B here tomorrow morning that will go into better detail because that's what they actually do.
Can you follow?
Yeah, but that's not required of them, of the current piece of legislation. That's something that they're just planning to do, correct?
Mr. Elber.
Through the chair, Mr. Chairman, I believe that it is required in the bill. I might not be the most qualified person to answer that question in detail, but R&B's fiscal note that we have on the table, which talks about their implementation cost, I believe includes language about how they will be guiding employees through that process.
Thank you.
Sarah Merrick.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If Mr. Kolwarski is still online, I have a question on slides 8, 9, and 10.
Mr. Kolwarski.
Yes, I'm still here.
Great. Okay.
Can I just ask you, before we get started into Senator Merrick's question, do you have the committee substitute in front of you?
Is that being asked of me?
Yes.
I've seen it, but it doesn't have any impact on our numbers.
Okay. Are you in favor of it?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. Senator Merrick.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Kolwarski, thank you for your presentation. Just to break this down to very simplified terms, on 8, 9, and 10, you have baselines for TERS, PERS, and PERS public safety. Am I understanding correctly that TERS, the defined benefit plan, saves us as employers a significant amount? For PERS, it's about status quo, and for the public safety, it's more expensive.
Mr. Kowalski.
I apologize. Who's asking the question?
Senator Merrick.
Senator Merrick, sorry, and through the chair, you have that. You are correct.
Thank you. And follow-up?
Follow-up, please.
Is the reason that the PERS safe for public safety is so much more expensive because of the qualification for retirement or the benefit calculation formula, or what is causing that significant difference?
Mr. Kowalski.
Senator Merrick, and through the chair, definitely is impacted by the retirement eligibility. And I'm looking here at the primarily the retirement eligibility.
And what slide is that, sir?
That's not a slide. I'm just reviewing the summary of Senate Bill 88. It's not on the slide.
Thank you. Any further questions? I'm sorry. Follow-up, Senator Mayor?
Yes, just one follow-up, Mr. Chairman. So the baseline combined on page 7 shows that with all three of those combined, the defined benefit plan is slightly less expensive for the state, correct?
Senator Merrigan, through the chair, that is correct.
Thank you very much.
Senator Stedman.
Yes, just a little different question, because we recognize that defined benefit plans are attractive until they have an unfunded liability, and the numbers change. So that's the hot potato. But without that, with that being said, can you help me with the concept that why we would close down the current tier, new tier, the defined contribution plan, and not run it concurrently with this plan? Because it seems like if you're a younger person in your 20s or 30s or maybe even early 40s, and you're not going to work for the state for 30 years, maybe you're going to only work for 5 years or 10 years or 15 years, you're better off under the defined contribution plan because you have the control of those assets and they can grow to retirement, or your salary replacement under the defined benefit is frozen going forward. So why would we disprivilege those Alaska citizens that are not going to work for 30 years for the state, but only going to work for 10 or 15?
Mr. Kowalski.
Senator Stedman, through the chair, the entire purpose of a defined benefit plan is to ensure that anybody who works an entire career has a pension at retirement. If you take people that turn over, that only stay a few years and let them keep their defined contribution balance, you then dramatically escalate the cost for everybody else. So there is a trade-off there. And in order to collect a lifetime pension, some of it's on the backs of the people that just come and go.
Okay, so
please, without objection.
With that, Mr. Chairman, it would be nice at some point. And I recognize this is on the speed track, so that is what it is. But it would be nice for us to get a better understanding of the length of longevity of our employees over time also. And I think some of that data might be available from retirement and benefits, because we do, I think, all agree we want to slow it down. In other words, slow down the turnover and increase the longevity.
Senator Bishop, you had a question?
It's just a comment, if we've got time.
Go ahead. Without objection.
I know a guy one time that was in a DB plan and stayed current and paid his union dues, but went salary because the company had a great plan. Then after 20 years, they lost all their assets overseas, including his pension plan, and he came back to work into his trade union and worked till he was 67 so he could have a retirement.
Okay. Any other questions?
I just have one, Mr. Chair.
Oh, Senator Wilson.
And just one question here, and we're talking about some of the baselines on Senator Merrick's sort of the combined PERS and then the PERS safety. Would it be better just to have the one PERS, in your opinion, or have the multiple separate plans?
Mr. Kowalski.
I believe I'm muted.
You're unmuted.
You're loud and clear.
Sorry. I didn't hear the full question.
Yes.
Can it be repeated?
Senator Wilson.
Yes. This is Senator Wilson. Just on Senator Merrick's question, sort of the baselines and looking at the PERS other and the PERS safety, in your opinion, professional expertise, is it better to have sort of a one combined plan with multiple more enrollees in that one plan, or to have multiple separate plans with different qualifiers? And
Mr. Kowalski.
Senator Wilson, through the chair, you can combine all the groups into one plan, but still have different provisions. And that is the desirable way to go, because you share in the mortality risk, you know, the longevity risk, and they all get the same investment returns. But within that single plan, you can have separate provisions for different groups.
Follow-up, Senator Wilson.
I guess my question is then, is it better to have lots of different provisions within that group? How does that vary with the numbers?
Mr. Kowalski.
Senator Wilson, through the chair, I'm not sure I fully understand the question, but the combined projection scenarios that we showed does have everybody together in one plan, and it does have the separate provisions that you just suggested. Slides 8, 9, 10 were simply demonstrations of if those plans, if you only provided for public safety or teachers or PERS, what would it look like? As my understanding, SB 88 does put them all into one plan with a separate provisions, though, for the different groups.
Senator Stemmer has a question.
Let me ask it in a little different light, because it's a policy question we've been kicking around the table. We recognize that a lot of our police and fire that are in the plan are employed at the municipal level, not at the state level, and that's why they're out of SPS or Social Security. And that's a difficult nut to crack, and we're trying to figure that out. PERS and TERS, I guess the fundamental question is, why wouldn't it be better off if we had one plan instead of two? The TERS members are not included in SBS, and would that then allow them to come in under SBS? So it would be regardless if you work for the school district or you work for public works for the state, you'd be in the same retirement plan, because it looks like the salary replacement targets are very similar, if not exact, under this plan. Wouldn't it be, and is it something we could do to make our plan more efficient across the state and fair to all the employees, no matter if they're a school teacher or a dump truck driver?
Mr. Kowalski.
Senator Stedman, those are all policy issues. It's not really an actuarial matter, but policy issues worth considering.
Follow-up, Senator Stedman.
Yeah, the reason I'm asking that, because you guys work all over the country. I know I recognize it's not a numeric question, a calculation question, but do other states, any other states do that, have a combination where everybody's just together and it's for efficiency or not?
Senator Stedman, through the chair, it's my understanding that everyone is together in this SB 88. We're only identifying that if they were separated, what it would look like. So I think this is going to be a single sub-trust.
Senator Stedman?
Not necessarily, because TERS cannot be in SBS, and they opted out of Social Security. So the retirement question is, how do you get TERS, the teachers, in so they have a higher salary replacement number, because they're missing part of a retirement structure that other state or the state workers normally have? How do we solve that problem? I guess I'm asking for help on that, because we don't have the expertise and you guys are the experts.
Mr. Kowalski.
Senator Stedman, through the chair, I wish I could answer. I don't have a good enough familiarity with your who's eligible for what in the Social Security. We were just honed in on SB 88 and it providing a baseline pension. But I understand what your issue is, but we would have to look into what those eligibility criteria are for the different groups. So I apologize for not having the answer here.
Senator Wilson.
Yeah, just one I guess final question. Just if you can answer, just when did you start your analysis work on SB 88 in terms of, and how long have you been working on just this piece of legislation that's before the committee today?
Mr. Kowalski.
Senator Wilson, I believe we've been working on this for about a month. However, we had a lot of lead time because a year ago, working under a somewhat similar bill for the House, a lot of the groundwork was laid there. So a lot of that work was easily transferred to this effort in the past month.
Follow-up, Senator Wilson. Okay, if you don't have any other issues to bring up,
I guess Senator Wilson. I guess I do. When were you contacted? By whom were you contacted? Because this legislation hasn't. So we were contacted to work on this piece of legislation on as an inception. to when it was first divvied out?
That's probably a better question for Senator or Mr. Alper.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Ken Alper, staff of the Finance Committee. To Senator Wilson's question, I personally got involved with this project a few weeks before Labor and Commerce was finished with it. They knew it was going to be a finance project, and as the bills manager for the co-chair, they thought it was worthwhile to get me up to speed. We talked about what the Finance Committee might need and realized that some independent actuarial analysis would be helpful to support, counterpoint, just have another set of eyes versus what we knew would be coming in from the administration, Buck Consulting, the Department of Administration's actuary. So Mr. Kalwarski was recommended because he had worked, as he said, on prior legislation. In particular, there was a statewide pension bill, House Bill 220, I believe was its number in the previous legislature. I reached out to him. He was available and interested. This was about a month ago. We found some committee funds we were able to hire him with and got him on the payroll. So although his analysis might not be as comprehensive and deep and long-standing as, say, Buck, who's been deep into our pension systems for decades, his experience and his qualifications and his pre-existing math enabled us to get some reasonable analysis in a fairly compressed time period.
I think the proper way to say it is he's not on the payroll. He's got a contract.
Mr. Chairman, that is correct. He's a contractor to the Senate Finance Committee.
Chair Wilson.
Correct then. So as you said, Mr. Alper, wouldn't it be better to use our folks that know our payroll, know our systems, know our liability, know our ins and outs of the longevity of the payroll system, and was Buck not available to hire and to contract for that?
First of all, Mr. Wilson, maybe I'll answer that question. We were getting some resistance from the powers that be to go ahead and get that stuff out. And because of that, we went ahead and went this route. You want to further comment on that, Senator, Mr. Alper?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yeah, and Buck, we did actually reach out to Buck and were told by the Department of Administration that they're on contract with the executive branch, that it would have been a conflict. We could not independently contract with them, so we had to find an actuary other than the one that was currently working for the Division of Retirement Benefits.
Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just appreciate the level of analysis here, the extent of the work on the bill. This bill's been in the legislative process now longer than Senate Bill 141, that created Tier 4, was from first introduction to final vote on the second free conference committee report.
You remember that time?
And I appreciate very much that we have both the executive branch's actuaries and actuary on contract to the legislative branch looking at this. That doesn't match my recollection of 2005. One of the great things that Senate Bill 141 did was put in place multiple actuaries, some to check the work of the others, to challenge their assumptions, to make sure we're getting a solid look. So I think we're on a very good track here, and I appreciate having Chiron Actuaries and Mr. Kolwarski available, and I'm glad we're doing all the due diligence.
Senator Stedman.
Yeah, it doesn't hurt to have multiple actuaries look. I think we have the other fella that here, Flick, I can't remember his last name. He's presented and worked on the bills. This company's worked on the bills.
You're talking about Desai?
Cornea.
Pardon me?
You're talking about Desai?
Yes. No.
Cornea.
Cornea.
Oh, cornea. Okay.
And then we'll have the actuarial firm that does the work for the Department of Retirement Benefits, my understanding, before it leaves the committee, along with fiscal notes and some cost issues. I have no problem with multiple analytics run on a particular piece of legislation. It's good to have differences of opinion. And frankly, I think they'll all synergize and be very, very close. But there's some other issues that we haven't touched on yet that we'll get into later that may differentiate some of the issues here. But
if we have no further questions by members of the committee, we'll have this bill sponsor come on up and give her opinion on the committee substitute that is in front of us. Senator Giesel, please identify yourself for the record and go ahead with your
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Kathy Giesel, I am privileged to represent Senate District E in the State Senate. Mr. Chairman, looking at the changes to this bill, I appreciate them. They are simply some clarification items, but perhaps change number six is extremely positive. It does go from a four-month period to a six-month period for the employee to make the choice between remaining in the DC system and transferring to the DB system. We know that the Division of Retirement and Benefits is understaffed, Mr. Chairman. We got that from the Ombudsman's report, and so this will give that staff some additional time to actually do the work. There were some questions asked about facets of the bill that don't cover areas of concern, the subject being Social Security and SBS, Mr. Sherman. And we did look at how to solve that particular issue. In speaking with the group that represents municipalities, Alaska Municipal League, they expressed concern about this subject also, and I would urge you perhaps to consult them as far as whether groups should be forced, as it were, or required, that is, to go into SBS or Social Security. Related to this actuarial report today, I appreciate the comments made by Senator Keel. We want multiple actuaries. That's actually how the ARM board functions, Mr. Chairman. They have an annual actuarial assessment, and then every 3 to 4 years they have a secondary one that comes in to evaluate what's been done. That was the whole problem that happened with Mercer, I will remind everyone. And I know this is a very informed board. There were questions about the past service liabilities, the past service costs. The generic term for that, or the colloquialism, is unfunded liability. But the bill refers to it as past service liability. That's a technical term. And you'll find that in sections 37 and 38, Mr. Chairman, where it speaks about the ARM board's work itself. That's the Alaska Retirement Management Board. We call it the ARM board. But, Mr. Chairman, they are constantly making sure that those past service costs are being covered. There's a constant appropriation, as it were, or taking some of these funds and moving them constantly into paying off that past liability. So just a few comments, Mr. Chairman. I do appreciate version O, as in Omega, and thank you for hearing the bill today.
Senator Hopper has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Giesel, you said forcing the members to participate in SBS or Social Security. To me, SBS, why would anybody even think that it's a force? They would contribute 6.13% and the state would match that. Any employee, you know, if I were looking at a system, it wouldn't take much convincing to me to say that if I put up a dollar and the state would put up an additional dollar for retirement of my wage, I would jump at the chance. So I'm wondering why you chose those words.
Actually, Mr. Senator Sovlin, she didn't say, she amended her statement that went from required to, or that went from forced to required.
Required, yes. Why?
Senator Giesel.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Hoffman, my suggestion is that you speak to the Municipal League for their input. I'm simply sharing what I heard them say to me. And your brilliance on this community, this committee's brilliance in these subjects far exceeds mine. I'm only conveying what I heard.
Thank you. I will bring that up with the Municipal League.
Okay. We still have a committee substitute in front of us. Senator Bishop.
Brief at ease.
Senate Finance meeting back to order. I'll remove my objection. Is there further objection to members of the committee but for this committee substitute? If not, the committee substitute is adopted. We have before us 88/0 for our working document. We've previously set an amendment deadline for today at 5 p.m. And we'll take up the bill tomorrow morning. With that bill, without further ado, if there are no further things, we'll set this bill aside. We'll take a brief at ease. Call the Senate Finance Committee back to order. Next bill up we're hearing is Senate Bill 95 by Senator Merrick, which has to do with license plates. The bill was first heard on May 10th, where we took public testimony. We asked for amendments, and none were received. Do you have additional comments, Senator Merrick?
Thank you for hearing the bill, sir.
Any further questions by members of the committee for the bill sponsor? Any committee discussions over the bill? Do we have a motion?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move Senate Bill 95, version 33-LS0517/B from committee with individual recommendation, attached fiscal note, and authorize legislative legal services to make conforming changes.
Without objection, the bill passes from committee onto the next committee referral.
Thank you, sir.
We'll take a brief at ease to sign the paperwork.
call the Senate Finance Committee back to order. This concludes this morning's agenda. This afternoon, we'll be hearing Senate Bill 48, the Carbon Office Bill by the Governor. Senate Bill 138, Elections by State Affairs. If there's no further business to come before the committee, we're adjourned at 10:30.